I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have an interview with Rick Newcomb, and Rick just brought out a book called The Magic of Lifting Weights. He is in his 70s and he has been weight training ever since he was a teenager. So it was a very interesting book. I saw Rick being interviewed on RX Muscle by Dave Palumbo, and he talks about meeting many of the legends in the sport, including Rock Stonewall when he was a kid growing up in Chicago. He also got to see Sergio Oliva pose for the very first time in the United States, which was amazing. I think that was like in 1964 or something like that. And then when Rick grew up, he moved out to Santa Monica. And he was a very successful executive with the Los Angeles Times. And he started training with Franco Colombo. Franco designed his workout program for him. And he also met Arnold Schwarzenegger and was pretty good friends with Arnold. And then for a while, he was actually the training partner of Bertel Fott. So Rick has got some really good stories about some of the legends of the sport. I thought he'd be great to bring on the show. So we'll be getting to that interview in a minute. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. So what's going on in your world, guys? As we mentioned on the show last week, unfortunately, we saw the passing of Dave Draper last week. That was very sad. Dave was 79 years old, and he died on November 30th. But I believe he was having heart problems for the last 2 years. So now he is resting in peace. So we will never forget, of course, the Blonde Bomber. And I gave a little tribute to Dave on my show last week. So if you didn't get a chance to listen to it, check out the podcast from last week, where we also interviewed Ed Connors and Tim Kimber. And I really enjoyed that interview that we did. If you didn't check that out, it was really a good one. I put that interview on YouTube, so I'm going to read the comments from that in a second. I didn't get any emails from you guys this week either. So I will just read the comments on that YouTube video. Also, last week, I was featured as a guest on a podcast called Most Muscular, and you can find this on YouTube if you're on YouTube. Jason Naz is the moderator, but he had a lot of good guests on there, some bodybuilders who I never had a chance to meet, and it was really great meeting them. One was Ian Harrison, who was the great British bodybuilder. If you ever saw Ian compete, he had really good leg development, a big guy, over 6 feet tall, and a small waist. I always thought he should have did better in the competitions than he did. So Ian is now living in Florida, so he was a guest on the show. Brian Pateracki, who was a really good competitor out here in Florida, he was a national-level competitor and I'm now retired from competing, and he is just training clients. In fact, Jason Naz, who was the moderator, is one of his clients. And also on the show is Phil Williams, who is a friend of mine, and he has been on our podcast many times. And they also had Steve Brisbois, and Steve was a great Canadian bodybuilder, got his pro card as a bantamweight, and then competed as a pro for several years. So check that out. I'll put the link to the interview on the description below. So if you want to check it out, it was about an hour and a half podcast, and I really enjoyed talking to those guys. So thanks to Jason for having me on. He said he's going to have me on again. And I was also on RX Muscle last week with Dave Palumbo, and we did a tribute to Dave Draper. So I'll also put the link for that podcast below. And I will put the link for the last one that we did, our last podcast, which was, again, the one with Ed Connors and Tim Kimber. Okay, after we get done with our interview with Rick Newcomb, I am going to read an old article, but you guys are going to love this one. I just put together, if you're ever on my YouTube page, I had this series of videos called Bodybuilding History. And I basically went back to the 1960s. And I think I started with the 1965 Mr. Olympia. And I also started with the 1970 NABBA Universe. And I kind of went backwards with the NABBA Universe. I think I went all the way up to 1966 when Arnold took second to Chet Yorton. And I'm going forwards with Mr. Olympia. So we started with 65 and I did 66, 67, 68. And I just put together a video for 1969. So that should be up on YouTube in this week. So check out my YouTube channel under my name, John Hansen, and the 1969 Mr. Olympia contest should be up. So anyways, I was looking for some old muscle builders that I have, looking at my collection, and I was trying to get some pictures from the 1969 Olympia, which also featured the Mr. America and the Mr. Universe, I believe, for that night. And I came across a 71 issue of Muscle Builder, and this one has the full contest report from the 1970 Mr. Olympia, where Arnold beat Sergio for the first time. And it also had the Mr. World contest, where Dave Draper beat Rick Wayne and Franco, and the Mr. America contest, where Mike Katz finally won. So it was written by our good friend Rick Wayne, who was one of the best writers in the bodybuilding field. And I'm going to read this article. And it's a long article, but I'm sure you guys will love it. So as soon as our interview with Rick Newcomb is over with, listen to this article. It's called The IFBB Celebrates a Super Anniversary, and it is from the April-May issue, 1971 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. You're going to love this one, man. This is golden age stuff right here. All right, so let me read some of the comments that we got on my YouTube channel under the Ed Connors, Tim Kimber interview. It's getting some good views. Ralph said, awesome. I love hearing about the old stories. It brings back a lot of memories. Peter Roberts said, with the passing of Dave Draper, these videos are so much more poignant. Well done, John. Jerry said, it's great to hear these stories. I was proud to be part of the Golds family as an owner of Golds in Oklahoma City, and after moving to Southern California and training at Venice. Big thanks to Tim and Ed for all their help and support, a couple of great individuals. Sihan says, hearing these nuggets of wisdom really helps me appreciate the work they put into the past in bodybuilding. They apply now. Joseph said, fantastic. And isn't it so cool that the circle of bodybuilding really took off at Gold's Gym? And since bodybuilding history is not dispersed over many years like other sports, the participants show up in multiple places. I heard Boston Lloyd's father on a podcast not too long ago, and boom, Ed is talking about him. Great job, John, as always. Thank you. Yeah, Ed, Boston Lloyd's father is John Lloyd, and John was a really good competitor in the 1980s. And I did an interview with them as well. So if you want to check out that interview, just go to the official website of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And you will see the interview with John Lloyd. It was a really good interview. I really enjoyed talking to him. He was a great guy. Chris said, I love the old school content, mate. DWW said, great show, John. I love the intro. Rice said, thank you, John. I love your channel so much. Jamie said, you do such an awesome job. I love your videos. Chris Widener says, as always, thanks and all the best. Danger said, thank you, John, for the inspiration to train. I got back to working out after 50, after 20 plus years of eating crap, literally junk food. No exercise. I'm now turning 56 this month. I can see my abs working now on the love handles. John, you give hope to us older, natural guys. At 25, I used to eat and work out like the guys in the magazines. Too bad they didn't mention the enhancement drugs. I got fat eating 4,000 to 5,000 calories a day, and I gave up. I didn't learn nutrition until after 50. God bless you and your family. Thank you. Wow, that was a great email. Good job. 56, back at it. Keep it up. I told him the best years of his life are ahead of him. As long as he keeps training and eating good, I'm sure he's going to feel fantastic. Chris said, great stuff, John. King Size said, frigging awesome. Mark Dagg said, that was awesome. LH91. So thank you, John. Great channel. And Orange Revolution listed the YouTube link for the Heart to Heart show that was mentioned in the podcast. Thank you very much. All right. So that was the comments that we got on our Gold Gym Memories podcast with Ed Connors and Tim Kimber. And as like I said, if you guys want to email me with any comments you have, just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. Without any further ado, let's get to our interview with Mr. Rick Newcomb, the author of the book, The Magic of Lifting Weights. Here we go.
All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with me this week, Mr. Rick Newcomb, who just wrote a new book called The Magic of Lifting Weights. So, Rick, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, John. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I was reading your book, and I thought there was a lot of great stuff that you could share with our listeners here at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, because you met some of the great legends of bodybuilding, like Arnold Schwarzenegger. You worked with Franco Colombo. You met Frank Zane, and you actually worked out for many years with Fertile Fox.
That's all true. I even met John Grimmick and Bob Hoffman.
Wow.
And I saw Sergio Oliva and talked to him. He didn't speak any English. The first time he ever posed in America, he had just come over from Cuba. He had defected. He was a weightlifter in Cuba, and he had a translator, and I was a little kid. Me and my friends, I sort of initiated all this. We went backstage, and there was Sergio pumping up to do guest posing in Chicago. This was, I think, at the Duncan YMCA or Division YMCA, one of those.
Yeah.
Where Bob Gaida came from. And And I think Sergio wound up training there. And there was another fellow named Bill Sino.
Yes. Yeah. I know Bill. Yeah.
Great. So now, due on the age thing, I was probably 12 or 13 years old.
Okay.
So Bill then was probably 24. I think I've looked that up. And
what year was that, Rick?
It would have been 63.
Okay.
Or thereabouts.
Yeah.
They just could not have been nicer, you know, to me and my friends. I mean, here we are, a bunch of little kids backstage saying, wow, how do you get muscles like that?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I've been training. I started training wanting to be a champion bodybuilder. And that was when I was like 12.
Okay.
So strength and health. I saw this bodybuilder named Guy Mirzuk.
Yeah.
France on the cover. He had such a symmetrical build and a tiny waist and nice lats and so terrific. And, you know, I bought that magazine. I brought it home. I couldn't stop reading it. I bought all the magazines. And later at some point, I mean, I can tell the whole story. I do tell the whole story in the book. The book's called The Magic of Lifting Weights, if I could.
Right.
My wife said, you got to hold up your book, you know.
That's an impressive front double bicep pose, too.
Yeah. And it was taken, you know, no, I didn't hire a photographer. There was nothing. It was my 68th birthday. We have somebody I work with. We have a gym at the office here in Hermosa Beach, California. And I was working out one morning, and there's an employee named Sheila, who was born on August 8th, which is my birthday.
Okay.
And she poked her head into the gym. We have glass walls so that she could see me working out. And she said, happy birthday, Rick. It was my 68th birthday. And I said, happy birthday, Sheila, because she's younger than me, but both August 8.
Right.
And then I said, Sheila, I just got this new iPhone. Can you do me a favor? It's supposed to have a good camera. Can you just take a picture? And I flexed, and I liked the picture. And I thought, better to do it that way than hire a photographer and diet for it and do all that
stuff. Yeah, so we share that, too, in common. Rick, we grew up in Chicago.
Yes, sir. I grew up in Winnetka, a suburb of Chicago on the North Shore.
Yeah, okay. I was from the southwest suburbs.
Yep.
Yeah.
So what happened when I was like, you know, I saw that first Strength and Health. They had a picture of this bodybuilder named Rock Stonewall. Mm-hmm. And he was standing with his shirt off at a department store with York barbells, you know, he's promoting them.
Yeah.
And so I was pretty enterprising. I called, in those days, you call 411, and I asked for because it said he worked at Eaton's Health Food Store on Van Buren Street in downtown Chicago.
Okay.
So I called the number and I said, is Rock Stonewall there? And they said, yeah, just a minute. So he came on the phone And I just blurted out, because remember, I'm 12. I said, I can't believe I'm talking to a champion bodybuilder. I'm looking at your picture in the magazine and you're talking to me on the phone. How can I meet you? And he was, you know, he laughed and he was a really nice man. And he said, he was 24 also at that time.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm 12. So it, think of a 12-year-old and a 24-year-old. One is a child, the other is an adult. So he told me where he was. I ran and I asked my mom, I said, can we go down to Van Buren Street? Do you know where that is? And my dad, and they said yes. And so on a Friday afternoon, my mom and I got in the station wagon and drove downtown to pick up my dad. He worked at the Chicago Sun-Times and Daily News newspapers.
Oh, really? Right. What did your dad do?
Well, he started as an accountant. I mean, he was like with Arthur Andersen, and he had grown up on a farm in Minnesota, and then he became a really good accountant. And then he worked for Field Enterprises. His whole business career after Arthur Andersen was with Field, as in Marshall Field, but not the they had sold off the department store, but they owned a lot of publishing houses. Besides the Sun-Times and Daily News, they owned World Book Encyclopedia. At one time, they owned Simon & Schuster. It was a big, big publishing outfit. And so we picked him up and we drove, you know, maybe a mile to Van Buren Street, right at the corner. It's just half a block in from Wabash and Van Buren.
Okay.
And they had a $1.19 Tad's Steakhouse, $1.19 steak. So anyway, we go in and see Rock, and he buy a few vitamins. I couldn't believe how buff he was and how nice and sweet, and he had a smile like Magic Johnson, just really charismatic, and all these big trophies, you know, from his Mr. America Short Division or Mr. World.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
He was in the IFBB. I didn't know anything about what that meant later. And then he said, have you seen the gym? And we said, what gym? He said, it's called Triumph Gym. It's right, you know, half a block down, almost next door to this building. So we went out there, and it was this old brown brick building, maybe four or five stories. And they had one of those elevators, like in the old days where you have a cage that you open. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So we waited for that elevator. You could hear it coming down. We got into it, very tiny, just me and my parents, and we were all like that. And we go up, I think probably one flight of stairs. I don't know why we, maybe two. I don't know why we took an elevator, but, and I saw this gym, and, you know, I was 12 years old, and I could not think of a better way to spend a Friday night than working out, lifting weights. This was a world that just looked so cool to me.
I just
thought, this is fantastic. And later I went back. My dad came down with me on a Saturday and talked with the manager named Bill Jacobs, who was a really nice guy. And he said, look, if my son were to come down here and work out, would he be safe? And Bill said, yeah, because I'm here all the time. I'd watch out for him. Okay. And they let me work out while this was going on. And I was small for my age and size. This is probably why I wanted to lift weights. I was probably not even 5 feet tall and not even 100 pounds in eighth grade. And so I started working out at home, you know, in the basement. I bought all the magazines, but my parents bought me a York bench and a few. I had one pancake breakfast charity fundraising thing. I won a contest for selling the second most pancake tickets. I was very upset that I won second most. And the reason I won it was the two brothers teamed up. They pretended as if only one of them saw.
Okay. two against one.
The problem was, and this was Boy Scouts, I think. The problem was my dad was a judge. So he said, I know they lied, but I couldn't do anything. I asked them straight. They said, oh, no, I'm the only one who sold them. And so they got first prize. I got second. All right. And the first prize was a fancy bicycle. Second prize was a $15 gift certificate to Wilmette Sporting Goods, which I think is still in business. So we drove over there on a Saturday. And what do I see but barbells and dumbbells for $15? So I used my gift certificate. And I learned a life lesson, you know, that sometimes everything does work out for the best.
Right.
That was a great story. Anyway, so I worked out a lot. I got all my friends to work out. I tell them the story how one of the guys was Ed Hoban, who later wound up in Aspen with, he was really good friends with the best-selling writer Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh, yeah, yeah. From Rolling Stone, yeah.
Right. And Ed and I syndicated, Creator Syndicate, we syndicated Hunter Thompson, the company.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. And Ed was his really good friend. And then when Hunter died, we had some kind of reunion or something at our school, and we started talking, and we realized that we both knew Hunter and interacted, but we didn't know that when he was alive. There was another guy, Luke Matthews, and in high school, his best friend was Bill Murray, who became, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember Bill Murray at Loyola Academy. He was like one of 15 kids, Irish Catholic, you know, and I was one of 8, so it wasn't that unusual.
Was Bill your age? Did you guys go to school together?
Yeah, we were in the same class.
No kidding.
He was, you know, a comedian. He was a football player and a little bit of a bully.
Oh, yeah.
But he never bullied me because I was friends with Luke.
Okay.
They went off to college. They were really close. They went off to college together. They were roommates at Regis College. And I read once where Murray's first son is named Luke. And my guess is he named him after Luke Matthews, but I don't know.
No kidding. Oh,
yeah. So when we went to a 50th reunion of our grade school, where we had all been at kindergarten through 8th grade together, there was a guy in Chicago named Stephen Dowdle, who's a very successful businessman. He lives in Colorado now in retirement. And I think he's retired. I don't know. He came up to me and he said, "How are you so ahead of your time? How did you know there would be this health and fitness revolution over the last 50 years? So how'd you know that 50 years ago?" I said, "Stephen, I wish I knew." I did not know. All I knew was that I wanted big muscles.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that contest where you saw Sergio and Bill Cino. That wasn't a Mr. America contest. That was just a local contest, right?
Local, like Mr. Chicago Lance.
And they were the guest posers.
They were the guest posers.
Okay. But back then it was easy to, you could go backstage, right? There was no security or anything. Yeah.
100%. 100%. And they were just so nice. They were flattered that all these young boys were there saying, "Wow, can I have your autograph?"
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Bill was a teacher at Eisenhower High School. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, he was like a little bit ahead of my time because I wasn't in bodybuilding in the 60s. But people would always talk about him with such reverence, you know, like, "Oh, yeah, Mr. Cino, you know. And I thought it was overblown. And then I found out later who he was. And then he won the most muscular trophy at Mr. America. And I think he was second one year. And then you got to see Sergio right when he came to the United States, right?
Right. First time he posed in
the That was the first contest he ever posed at. That's amazing. Contest.
I asked him, you know, I asked the translator, I said, "What does he do? How does he earn a living?" He said he's a television technician. So that must have been Sergio's first temporary job before he became.
Yeah, I heard he did that in Miami before he moved to Chicago.
Okay. So he became a legendary Chicago policeman.
So what did you think of him, Rick, when you saw him?
Oh, he was a monster. I never saw anything like it.
Yeah. Did he stand out from everybody else?
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah. And I went to, it was at Lane Tech.
Yeah.
1964 Mr. America. And I went on Saturday to the pre-judging.
Okay.
And in those days, that's when they decided 100% who won. So contest in the evening, which I couldn't go to because I didn't have a car and I didn't have a ride and my parents said I had to get home. Okay. But I did spend all day at the prejudging and it's imprinted in my brain.
Yeah.
And I thought for sure Sergio was first and Bill Cino second. And Val Vasilev, who came in first, was third.
Yeah.
But they didn't do it that way. Sergio was seventh.
Seventh. That's amazing.
I remember talking to Rock about it, and Rock said, "Well, you know, the AAU will never let a black bodybuilder win."
Right, right.
For America. And I wonder
if that's why Rock competed in the IFBB, because I know he did very well in the IFBB.
He did, and that's why.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. You got to see Sergio in his very first show, and the first time he posed in America. That's crazy.
That's right. It was historically significant. But at age 12 or 13, I had no
idea. Yeah, no idea. No. Yeah. So you were training and you were really into being a bodybuilder. And then after a certain age, you stopped, right? Because you just didn't believe that you could build the muscles or you just felt like you didn't have the potential.
That's right. I was like 14, 15, 16, and I was very slow in going through puberty.
Okay.
And all of my friends were putting on muscle, just playing football and doing sports much more than me. And here I was lifting weights and following the program. And what's really interesting, I remember one day Rock said he had hired a photographer, or maybe Weider did, I don't know. And he was going to have pictures taken that night. And he asked me if I wanted to go with him and have my pictures taken. I said, oh, yeah. And I had posing trunks in my gym bag. Why? Mm-hmm. I have no idea, but I did. Mm-hmm. And me and another kid who worked out with me, we were the same age. His name is Rocky. He lived in Logan Square. I would love to find out who he is and give him my book, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He was really a nice kid, and we both had the same dream. And Rocky's mom, you see, I was one of eight kids, so I called my mom, and I can just picture her with my seven brothers and sisters. And she just said, oh, yeah, okay, good. Just yeah. Don't be too late.
Yeah.
I got permission easy. But Rocky's mom didn't like this, you know. So he said, I got to go to Logan Square on the L to pick up my trunks, and I need you to talk my mom into it. And I said, okay. So I went with him, and his mom was very nice. And she said, okay, if you guys go together.
Where did you guys buy posting trunks back then?
I have no idea. I think probably Strength and Health, you know.
Okay.
Mail order things.
Okay.
So then we get into a car. Somebody was driving other than Rock and drive a couple miles to the south side. And we go in. It's a tattoo parlor. And it's pretty rough looking, you know.
Yeah.
Here we are, the only white guys and little kids, you know.
Yeah.
But we were with Rock, so it felt safe. And I was always friendly. And I said hello to, you know, and people said, hi. You know?
Yeah.
But they left us alone. And then we went backstage and took off our clothes and put on our trunks and oiled down each other's backs and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt so, you know, like a professional bodybuilder. So then we get the pictures, which I still had, and I put them in the book. And that really, it totally devastated me. It wiped me out. I was like, oh my God, I've been training so hard and following all the advice. And I am so far from Joe Abenda or John Grimmick or these mm-hmm. champion bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Danko, I don't, you know, it's not even close. I look like a little kid. Well, I was a little kid, you know, and so then I was always a natural reader. I loved to read
mm-hmm.
and I did really well. Later, you know, as I was like 16, 17, 18, I got into Georgetown University. I went through in 3 years. I was Phi Beta Kappa, Magna Cum Laude. Wow. You know, I was a really good student. I remember one time going to the registrar's office about something, and the guy next to me said, can you tell me my class rank? And in those days, they pulled out one of those giant IBM, you know, things, and what's mm-hmm. your name? And they find him, and she said, you know, your number 1,322 or something. And I said, I didn't know you could do that. What's my class rank? And I told her my name, and she says, whoa, you're a smart one, too. I said, what's two? You're number two in the class.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. You know? So I had that. And I really hardly worked out at all. I did a lot of walking, but I hadn't totally lost interest in it. And in fact, I helped found a newspaper that's still in business today called the Georgetown Voice.
Okay.
I did do a spread on bodybuilding, and I ran a big picture of Sergio Oliva on one side.
No kidding.
Wow. Paul Anderson on the other side, you know,
as
the most muscular man in the world and the strongest man in the world. That was my.
Yeah. Yeah. But now, Rick, did you want to get into the newspaper business because your dad was involved sometimes also?
That had a big influence. The only difference was that I was a writer.
Yeah.
My dad was an accountant.
Right.
So he was on the business side only, whereas I was more on the editorial side.
Did you write anything in high school? Were you writing papers in high school?
Yeah. The high school that I went to in Indiana at the end, I repeated my junior year because I really wanted to get into Georgetown. And I didn't have a shot.
Okay.
Really lousy grades at the local public school. So there was this brand new college prep school started in Indiana, about 60 miles from Chicago, called La Lemire.
Okay.
I was in the second class. There were only 16 kids in our class. And it's a great high school. You know who... my brother Doug went there, and in his class a few years behind me was a guy named John Roberts, who is now the U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Oh, wow.
His name John Roberts.
Yeah. Okay.
and the comedian Jim Gaffigan.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Jim went there. So they've had a handful of incredibly accomplished people.
Yeah.
Paris Barkley, he was, he's a Hollywood director, and I think he was president of the Directors Guild or something.
Okay.
And, wow. And many other success stories.
Yeah.
Tiny high school.
So when you went into college, did you stop training then? You weren't working out anymore?
Yeah. And at Lalamere, I was just doing sports, like, you know, soccer, baseball, whatever.
Yeah.
I did donate my weights to Lalamere because it was such a small school. They had a barn and we set up a gym. And I remember one Sunday afternoon, my dad and I got in that wood paneled station wagon. We had the York bench and some barbells and dumbbells, because what we had done before that was to use concrete, you know, in paint cans or in tiny paint cans and big paint cans with concrete in a bar. Yeah. That's what we were using before that. This is really old school.
That's a great story, though, about you being discouraged, because I'll bet so many kids in that era were discouraged, you know, because we only had the magazines and we could only see the pictures in the magazines. You know, all the social media stuff was not around back then. We couldn't see YouTube. We couldn't really see what the bodybuilders looked like all the time on these videos and everything. So I remember I went through the same thing when I was 14, when I started. I was working out at home also. And I remember looking at the magazines like, I'll never look like these guys. You know, these guys are they look like from another planet. And it was actually an article by Arnold. He wrote an article in Muscle Builder, and he was talking about the power of positive thinking. Yeah. And he brought up Frank Zane and Franco. And he said, here's two guys who did not have, when they started, it looks like they didn't have the genetics at all to be bodybuilders. Franco was very short and underweight, and Frank Zane was always very skinny. But he said through persistence, these guys trained and they eventually became Mr. Olympia winners. And that totally changed my attitude about bodybuilding and about my potential. And I was like, yeah, you just have to work hard and you can do it. So I give credit to Arnold for setting my attitude straight.
100%. 100%. Yeah. I was very motivated by Arnold. What happened was, after college, I got a job as a reporter with UPI, United Press International.
Okay.
It was in Baltimore. And I had joined a Holiday Health Club, you know, was working out a little bit over there. One of the good things about training so hard in my youth was that I learned how to do exercises, learned good technique. And that's invaluable. You know, this is a point I make in the book, that a lot of people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, the science is catching up, and they're saying, wow, lifting light weights with good form as a senior citizen is really beneficial. The muscle molecules chase away the fat molecules, the bone density increases, all kinds of the balance. You know, falling is a real killer for many of the elderly. When you lift a lot of weights, you over the years, or even if you just start as a senior with light weights, does improve your balance.
Yeah.
So many benefits. So when I was at UPI in Baltimore, we got these press releases all the time. And one of my jobs was to go through them and look for something interesting. And there was always something coming through. Well, Arnold had just published his first book, Arnold, The Education of a Bodybuilder.
Yes.
And Simon & Schuster published it. So I called Simon & Schuster and said, you know, I'm kind of interested in this book. Can you send me a review copy? What that means is they send it, you get it free, because you might write a review. And if you write a review, then it's well worth it for them to make that investment.
Yeah,
I got the book and I took it home and I read it. My wife and I, we were married at this point, living in a small apartment in Baltimore. And I really enjoyed it. I was very inspired. So I called Simon & Schuster and said, well, if Arnold's ever in Baltimore, I'd like to interview him. And they got back to me really quickly, like almost immediately. So obviously they called him and a week from Monday or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't realize, I think Maria Shriver.
Yeah, she was in Baltimore. She was
newscaster. He was in Baltimore, so he had a great excuse. He wanted to come.
Right.
So we met at a Hilton in the Inner Harbor, which was just starting to be developed at that time.
Okay.
And I figured out later, I was 27 and Arnold was 30. So he hadn't totally retired from bodybuilding, but he had already made pumping iron, which I didn't know about. I had never heard of it at that point.
Did you know who Arnold was? Because you were following bodybuilding before Arnold came around, right?
Yeah, I knew a little bit about him. I remember in the 60s stopping by Eaton's health food store. Well, I was in downtown Chicago. I went in to say hello to Rock. And I said, so what's going on in bodybuilding? Anybody new? And he said, yeah, there's this South African monster named Arnold something. He thought he was from South Africa. And that's because I think Arnold was pictured with Reg Park training.
South Africa. Right. Yeah. Okay.
I didn't realize he was the Austrian Oak.
Yeah. Yeah. But they were already talking about him back then.
Yeah. So at that breakfast, I was so impressed by Arnold. He said that he just said it so convincingly that I will become the number one movie star in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, because at that time, I think I didn't see a whole lot of movies, but I remembered seeing Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman. So I thought of those guys as
the number one movie stars. Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, do you think you'll be as big as Paul Newman or Robert Redford? And he said, oh, I'll be bigger, much bigger than those guys. I'm going to be bigger than Charles Bronson. I was thinking to myself, oh my God, you know, I had seen like on 42nd Street in those days, it was like where they had peep shows and then revenge movies like Charles Bronson, Death Wish.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, you know, I just thought how clueless. He was like a little boy, you know, from a small town in Austria, farm boy, you know, almost, but excited. I'm going to do it.
And yeah.
It was so impressive. It was refreshing.
Right.
Now, when Bronson died a few years ago, I remember reading his obituary in the LA Times, and it said during the 1970s, he was the number one movie star in Europe. So what Arnold said made perfect sense.
Okay.
Because this was in the 70s. So anyway, I was motivated to train. And I started, I also contacted Rio Blair.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He sold supplements. There was a guy named Freddie who was a salesman on the phone.
Okay.
I never met Freddie, but I loved the guy. He was a very great salesman. But I remember he would answer the phone. I'd say, Freddie, it's Rick Newcomb. How are you doing? And he would always say, oh, my God, if I felt any better, they'd have to put me in a cage. He had this great line, you know, a great positive attitude. So then at some point I got hired by the L.A. Times, which was a move up from UPI because there was more money and to become sales manager of the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. And then within a year, I was made general manager.
Okay.
So then I was able to combine editorial and business, which I liked both. And when we moved to Santa Monica, my wife and I, we were very poor. I mean, we brought almost all of our earthly possessions in my VW Beetle driving across country. I had no idea America was so big. You know? Took about 8 days or something, stopping at a lot of Motel Sixes on the way. But we looked for an apartment in Santa Monica, and we were able to find one that was just fantastic. And I checked World Gym because the original Gold's Gym, but it was on Hampton, not the original. This is the original one for the franchising operation.
Yeah, so, Ed Connors and Tim Kimber and Pete Kronkowski. Yeah.
This was their third location.
Yes, that is.
I think at that point, Ken Sprague still owned it, but right at that time, or maybe Ken, maybe Ed did move it.
Ken owned it when it was in Santa Monica.
On 2nd Street.
Yeah, and then he sold it, and then Ed and Tim and Pete moved it to Venice.
Right. Yeah. I did work out there, the one on 2nd Street, a few times, and I remember talking with Mike Mentzer, who was kind of cold and standoffish.
Okay.
But when he found out I was with the LA Times, he became suddenly very friendly.
What year was this, Rick, that you were over there?
78.
78, okay.
79.
Okay.
And I remember going over to the Golds on Hampton once they moved it to Hampton.
Yeah.
And early morning, like 5:30, 6:00, okay. There weren't a whole lot of people there. And I met Dan Duchesne, who's a really yeah. nice guy. And he was telling me, now you've got to get on roids if you want to put on muscle. And I said, Dan, you seem like a really great guy, but I like to lift weights for health and fitness.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be, I'm now at this point, I was like 28, 29 years old and hadn't really stuck with my weightlifting like I was when I was 13, 14.
So was it meeting Arnold that got you motivated to start training again?
Well, I was training right before that. I think training before that got me motivated to read Arnold's book and okay. then meet Arnold. And then he really inspired me.
Yeah.
I just loved his positive attitude.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I also met Lee Haney early one morning. I was working out at Hampton Gym and it was dark outside. And I remember this guy comes up to the fence and says, "Psst, hey buddy, open the gate, would you?" So I said, sure. So I opened it and it was Lee Haney.
You know? Wow.
Nobody knew who he was then. He's probably about 18 years old. He yeah. was so nice and friendly. And
yeah.
we became friends there. But then at some point I decided I wanted to try World Gym.
Okay.
So I went in early in the morning, about 5:00 in the morning. Because I was really career driven. So I had to do my workout very
quickly. Workout over with before your day started. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I had gone in on a Sunday, I remember.
Okay.
Joe Gold, and I was wearing a sport coat. And Joe Gold, you know how most gym owners would say, "Hi, welcome. You know, they're going to show you around or whatever." Joe Gold says, he sees the sport coat and he says, "Look, this isn't a sports club. I mean, we don't have a juice bar or anything." No, that's okay. I get it. So it was early in the morning, and this guy is doing incline benches with 315. Just hanging out the reps. He must have done 20 reps. I was just
wow.
me and him, the only two people in this gym. And he puts the bar up and says, "Can I help you?" Or what can you know? And I said, "Yeah, I'm thinking about joining. You know, I've been working out at Gold's and I wanted to try World." And he said, "You can't go wrong at either place. They're both great gyms." Then he told me this story, how Joe Gold founded Gold's, then became a merchant marine for a couple of years, came back.
Yeah.
In World Gym. So I said, "How much is it?" He said, $150 a year. So I said, "You know, I looked around. I got to tell you, it had carpeting. It was very small. It was like an apartment, but incredible. Everything was put away. Everything was clean. The dumbbells were very tight. Whereas in those days, Gold's dumbbells would rattle."
Oh, okay.
Pullovers. I was always afraid.
I think it was going to come off. Yeah.
lose some teeth.
Yeah.
So I just love the guy I was talking to was Steve Marjanian. Muscle Beach legend.
He was
one of the nicest people you could ever meet. I remember later getting to know Rick Drayson, and Rick told me we were having lunch once and talking about different people that if I recommended anybody he could have on a show. And I said one was Franco Colombo, and I did persuade Franco to go out there. And
okay. Yeah.
But another was Steve Marjanian. And he said, and Rick said, "Steve just won't do it. He, for some reason, he just won't do it." So yeah. He was just such a gentleman and a strong man. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I fell in love with World Gym, right at the one on Main Street, right off the bat.
Okay.
And I just started working out off and on, but I was, you know, still this executive at the LA Times. I became a vice president when I was 29 years old at the LA Times. So that was
wow. That's amazing.
And we were starting a family. Our daughter was born in 1979 and our son in 82.
Okay. What other bodybuilders did you see up there at Worlds?
Well, in the late 70s, I remember Tom Platz, Scalak.
I love Kel Scalak. Yeah.
Eddie Giuliani.
Yeah.
Zabo. I don't know. I'd have to go through, but there were tons. And then over the years.
Almost. We just lost Dave Draper a couple days ago. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
I did. Not in the gym.
Okay. But
I knew of Dave through Rock Stonewall.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was invited to go to Sacramento for when Arnold was governor. Governor Schwarzenegger had designated a certain day, Joe Weider Day.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And Joe invited me. I think my friend Charlotte Parker, who you've interviewed.
Yes. Yeah.
And Bob Gardner, a photographer who I was friends with, and Gail. And Franco was there, and Sylvester Stallone, who I had seen at the gym a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a really great day.
Wow.
What was your question?
I was asking if you ever met Dave Draper at the gym.
Dave. Oh, I spent a lot of time with Dave at that on Joe Weider Day.
Okay.
He was so nice. I asked him about Rock Stonewall. He said, "Oh, I remember Rock. What a great poser and charismatic, a sweet guy." Then I told him that Dr. Sam Wilson, he was a psychiatrist in Santa Monica who worked out really hard at World Gym, very strong guy, very nice. I said, "Dr. Sam told me that about you guys finding some wood in the Santa Monica Pier. I think they swam out and they take down wood, and then Dave made a bed for Arnold out of it."
Oh, they would swim out to get it? Really? Wow.
Truly. I think this was wood that it sort of was falling off. You know, they didn't take an axe to the
right.
But Dave was a fantastic carpenter and woodworker. And
yeah.
He made Arnold's bed out of that wood. It was a great story. There was another guy named Charlie who was a construction worker, short, very friendly, and he always worked out at World. And he would tell me Dave Draper stories. So I said, "Charlie says hello." And he said, "Oh, Charlie, I really miss him. He was..." But Eddie Giuliani told me that Dave, when they worked out in the dungeon in Santa Monica, Dave would go in like at midnight or 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. when nobody else would be around.
Right.
And they had, I think Eddie said it was a candle, but then I read later it was a 40 watt light bulb. But that's the only lighting in the room. It'd be almost pitch black.
Wow.
Total concentration.
Yeah.
And I remember reading a story in the 80s. And I told Arnold about this, and he said, "Oh, that's so cool. I get it. That when they were teaching people archery and how to stay focused on your target, sometimes what they would do is have them train in a like a cave that's pitch black, and the only thing they can see is the target."
Oh, wow.
So there's no outside distraction. And that's kind of how Dave Draper trained.
And Arnold was an archer, too. He used to shoot archery with Frank Zane, so I'm sure he appreciated that story. Yeah,
he did.
I could totally see Dave doing that because he was so into, you know, the feeling of working out, you know, and that's what he talked about with a lot of his writing and his books and stuff, how, you know, it's like a solitude, you know, it was like a very spiritual quest for him was working out. He didn't do it for any fame at all. It was just an inner thing, I think, for him.
That's right.
And that's what he writes about a lot in his books.
Yes. And he also wrote about, he went through a rough period where his, you know, the substance abuse got out of control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And because I remember Bertel Fox telling me once that Dave was really drunk at Bertel was doing a guest posing or something. And,
really? Wow.
Bertel was like 28 years old and Dave came up and put him in a headlock, you know, and he said, "Oh my God, the breath, you know." And I had lunch with Dave. I went to the Arnold Classic in the 80s. What I remember was Bev Francis competed. This was like,
women.
But I was a guest of Ben and Joe Weider, and I sat with them, and Ben was freaking out over Bev Francis. "We can't have that. We can't have muscles like that on women."
Right.
And Joe was like, "Ben, stop. Okay, I get the point." It was very funny. But I went into a restaurant. I was with a friend, and Dave Draper was standing there alone. And my friend said, "Oh, my God, you're Dave Draper." And, you know, we shook hands and said hello. And I said, were you like going to sit at a table alone? And he said, I said, "Well, come with us and we'll buy your lunch." So we had lunch with him. I remember he ate no carbs. So he must have been getting ready for something. But he was just such a great person.
Yeah, he was a really good person.
I loved his Bomber Blend protein powder.
Yeah, yeah.
It was my favorite. And when they discontinued it, I sent him an email and I said, man, that was my favorite. I miss it. He wrote back, me too. So clearly wasn't his choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at one point you started, you went to Franco for advice on getting in shape.
Yeah. So I tell the story both in the book and also my brother, John, is a fantastic filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a movie. I've got a YouTube page, which I never really pay much attention to. But we had an intern at the company one summer a couple of years ago who said, can I set up a YouTube page for you? And I didn't even know what it was. But I said, okay. So he set it up. And my brother John makes movies. And so I talked to him about the book and I showed him the manuscript. He read it. And he said, man, this is cool. I'd like to make a little mini documentary about it. So he made a 24-minute movie sort of about the book. That is, if you go on Rick Newcomb YouTube, and it's called A Bodybuilder for Life.
Okay.
It's really a good movie in and of itself. I'm not just saying that. But I tell the story that my wife, Carol, and I went to London. We didn't have a whole lot of money, but she always suggested that we, whatever money we had, we use on travel.
Okay.
And we took the QE2, the Queen Elizabeth II, back from England to America. And I'm sitting there looking at the vast ocean. You know, I'm like 30 years old and I was thinking about my life, you know, that at that point we wanted to start a family and our daughter was born, Sarah, who's now 42. So it gives you an idea of the passage of time. And I thought, wow, I had all these business goals and other goals for family, for whatever. But the bodybuilding goal, that was so important to me to look at least as good as Guy Mirzek, this guy on the Strength and Health cover.
Right.
What about, you know, why did I abandon that childhood dream? And I thought, why don't I give that a shot? And really, I didn't say that. I said, I am going to do that in the next 5 years, come hell or high water. I'm going to give it my all. Well, while balancing it out with this business career and family and it's the other thing. And, so when I got home, I was reading a Muscle and Fitness. Then I was really starting to get into it, reading the magazines. And there was a full page ad for Franco Colombo. So I called up and we were in an apartment in Santa Monica and he was in an office in Westwood, which is about 2 miles apart.
Okay.
And so I made an appointment with Franco to get a bodybuilding program. And I went in to see him. Now, I didn't realize this was like a month or two before he won the Olympia for the second time.
So in 1981,
That's right. It was July of 81. He was just massive. I mean, you can't
believe
wearing a white short sleeve business suit or shirt. His arms looked like they were going to burst the thing. Anyway, so he said, okay, take off your shirt. And I said, oh God, Franco, do I have to? He said, yeah, you have to. So I took off my shirt. Okay, he studied to the front, side, back. Okay, put your shirt on. Then he writes out a program, gives it to me. And then on the diet, he talked about the importance of eating fresh foods. He said, if it's wrapped in cellophane or comes in a package, try to avoid it. If it's, you know, chemicals, try to avoid it.
Yeah.
He basically followed a Mediterranean diet, which was very helpful. And I just followed his program religiously. And it was about an hour and a half workout, 4 times a week. Totaled 6 hours a week, which now at age 71, that's what I have been doing since then, since 1981. So you're really talking 40 years.
Yeah.
Missing a workout.
Yeah.
Now, as I'm in my 70s, I include walking and things in my workouts for my 6 hours.
Right.
So I went back to see Franco maybe a month later. And I was now at this point, I was totally settled on World Gym. It's where Arnold was training. It's where Franco recommended when he would come into a gym. That's the one he'd go to.
Okay.
To know Eddie Giuliani a little bit. I got to know Szabo. I like these guys. I like Joe Gold.
Yeah.
I understood his teasing. You know, he was really very funny.
Yeah.
Like one time when Mark our kids were little, I said, hey, Joe, why don't you have a, I was just reading these gyms are having daycare centers. You could have a daycare center. I can bring my kids and work out an extra hour. And he looks down on the street, Main Street, where traffic is going back and forth. He said, you want a daycare center? We'll set one up right in the middle of Main Street. So I went to see Franco a month later. And he got all bug-eyed. I'm not exaggerating. He said, I have never, he said, this is unbelievable. I never saw so much progress in 1 month. Unbelievable. Now, I had been watching my diet, and I had a lot of muscle memory from those early years that he didn't know about, and I wasn't aware of. I didn't realize how quickly the muscles would come back.
Yeah.
But God, I left his office, you know, just on cloud nine.
Yeah, feeling great. Yeah.
Mr. Olympia telling me I look great, you know. Right. So I doubled down and worked out harder than ever. And then about a year later, he said that he was writing a book called The Businessman's Minutes a Day Guide to Shaping Up.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, couldn't you have a shorter title? But he said, would you be willing to pose doing the exercises with me? I said, willing? Oh, my God, Franco, this is my dream. This, yeah. I would be so honored. So we did that. And I trained really hard. And then Frank Zane had something called Zane Haven.
Yeah.
That he and Christine promoted in Muscle and Fitness. So I asked Franco, what do you think if I go there for like a week of bodybuilding? He said, I think that's a good idea. He and Frank had competed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But he still had a lot of respect for Frank Zane. So then what happened, I remember at the LA Times, my boss went mountain climbing, kind of as a lark. And he collapsed and they thought he had had a heart attack. So they airlifted him to a hospital. It turned out it was just altitude sickness. So
okay.
He just died a couple of years ago. I think he lived to his 80s, early 80s.
Okay.
But I remember at the LA Times, they said, I said, look, I paid this $500. And that was a lot of money to me at that time. They said, well, we'll reimburse you, but you can't go. We need you there to run the syndicate. Well, Willard is in the hospital. And I said, okay. Then I called the Zanes and I spoke with Christine and I explained the situation. I said, I don't need a refund because the LA Times is reimbursing me, but would it make sense for me to come on Friday night? She said, of course, that way you would have Friday night a little bit and all day Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
So I did that. And that was a great experience.
This was 1982, Rick?
82.
Okay.
I remember getting to know a woman bodybuilder named Laura Combs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who just could not have been nicer. I remember I was doing leg raises and I had my head flat on the bench. And she said, no, always raise your head when you do leg raises.
Okay.
And here we are 40 years later. I still follow her.
Still do that. Yeah.
But I read on the internet that she died of alcohol poisoning.
Yeah. Several years ago. Yeah.
Apartment in Florida. It was just so sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was such a good person. I could
won the Miss America in 1980, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. But she was a really nice person. Well, so was Frank and Christine. I mean, their Zen thing is, it's real. And
yeah.
They have a lot of love. That's something I've concluded, that after a lifetime of lifting weights, and I say this in the book, that if you want to live a long life, one of the most important things is to feel love in your heart.
Mm.
Love for yourself and love for others. I mean that, where you really have good feelings, positive feelings.
Yeah.
I think Arnold works on that all the time, and he's successful. And he's had, obviously, in his personal life, he's had some real setbacks.
Yeah.
He stays positive.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. So what else did you learn working with Frank Zane? Because I think he competed that year, too. In 1982, he competed in the Olympia.
He did. Well, he taught me how to do a concentration curl the right way.
Mm-hmm.
He said when doing calf raises that we all knew to stretch at the bottom of calf raises.
Yeah. But
he recommended standing on when you get on your tiptoes at the top with weight, just hold that for a few seconds.
Okay.
That actually sharpens the calves.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There were little things like that. And then on diet, he said, yeah, Franco's right that year round a Mediterranean diet is fine and watching calories, but if you're going to compete or if you want to have sharp abs for the book, then you need to watch carbs too. So, you know, he gave a lot of dietary suggestions. Also, he called Rio Blair for me. And so I went over to Hancock Park and met with Rio Blair for the first time. And nice guy.
Yeah. And you met him in person. Yeah.
Met him in person. Now, what was really weird was I remember on Sunday, the Zanes had a swimming pool. So we all went out to the pool. So
okay.
About asking him questions about bodybuilding. And of course, we all put on our bathing suits. And when I walked out, Frank said, "Oh my God, are you going to compete?" Because I was really tan and lean. And
yeah.
I said, "No, but that's a nice compliment. I just want to look really sharp for Franco's book." When I saw Rio Blair, he, and I think I was wearing a business suit, but he said, "Hey, our supplements are designed to give people the look that you have. Why would, you know, almost like why this is like so perfect." Well, what was really interesting, and I write about this in the book, is that I didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
That because I had failed as when I was younger, that when I would get compliments, and Steve Merjanian once around that same time said, "Are you getting ready for a contest? You're ready." That I didn't believe it. I thought, well, maybe it's the suntan or the dieting, but not the muscles. That it takes a long time if you're lifting weights to appreciate your gains.
Yeah.
And one of the most important lessons I learned that I couldn't possibly have known when I was 13 or 14 was the importance of short-term goals.
Mm.
That's where Franco was so helpful.
Yeah.
Everything was short-term, 1 month, 2 months, 6 weeks. And he would say, "Okay, let's have a photo, set up a photo contest for yourself," or, you know, pretend like it's a contest to have your picture taken. Or I remember I tell the story in the book where I was going to Chicago, and it was around October 1st. I said, "Well, I'm going for a family reunion at Christmas. I don't suppose I can make too many gains between now and Christmas." And Franco said, "You can't believe the number of gains you can make in that short period of time."
Yeah.
And it just motivated me. So I had pictures taken then and pictures taken in Chicago. And, you know, he was right. That gave constant encouragement.
Yeah. So how did you start working out with Bertel Fox? How did that come about?
Okay. So I finished the Businessman's book. And so now I knew I needed a new goal. And I saw Bertel working out at World Gym. You couldn't help but see him. He was so strong.
Yeah.
So routinely bench pressing more than 500 pounds.
Yeah.
You name it. I mean, seated dumbbell presses with 120, 130.
Yeah. Yeah.
He'd warm up press behind neck with 135. That was his warm up.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. So I asked him, I had another brother, a different brother, who was moving to LA, who was a good photographer. And his name was Robert. And I said, "Robert, if there's this guy at the gym who I'd really like it if you could film him, if he'll let me." And Rob said, "Yeah, it sounds like fun. You know, I've never filmed a Mr. Universe or whatever." So then I said to Bertel, "What do you think? My brother's a pretty good photographer. He's got this VHS camera. If we filmed you doing your workout, and then we could give you a VHS tape that you would have for your grandchildren someday. And what's in it for me is that I could study it when I'm in my apartment. I could study the VHS tape, rewind, fast forward to learn better form." Well, it turned out Bertel had interesting form. He was the master of controlled cheating.
Right.
He used such heavy weights, but you would never call that good form. But on the other hand, it
obviously worked. Right.
Exactly. And so he bought in right away. He was very excited. So on a Saturday and a Sunday, we filmed this and gave it to him. Then Joe Weider saw it and he said, "Well, we could package this and sell this for you, Bertel." And he did. And they ran ads. And I think Bertel made a good amount of money on it. I didn't ask him for any money for it. I just had fun doing it.
Yeah.
I remember one part of that. Joe Gold said to Rob, my brother, now, if anybody complains, you can only film Bertel and tell them, like, if Lou Ferrigno says, you got to talk to my agent or something like that. There were a few guys who were touchy about this.
Yeah.
Joe was sensitive to it. Well, what happened was Arnold came in. And so I told him what we were doing. And at that point, Arnold was a movie star. He had already filmed Conan.
Yeah.
But this was before Terminator. So I said, would you mind like sitting on the bench next to Bertel and I could ask you guys questions and you could answer? He said, sure, that'd be fun. So mm-hmm. Arnold did it. Then everybody wanted to be in the movie. Very funny.
Yeah. So, and then you got the chance to train with Bertel. He asked you to be his training partner.
That's right. And I said, Bertel, how can I be your training partner? You bench press 500 pounds. I'm bench pressing 200 pounds. I mean,
yeah,
the whole time putting on and taking off plates. And he said, no, what we need to do is find one guy, your strength level, and you guys could help spot me and I could help spot you. And most of this stuff is done with pins and dumbbells. So the machines have pins and dumbbells. And so very few, you know, we don't do that many exercises with traditional barbells.
Right.
So I saw this guy, his name is Mike Myers. He worked out really hard and he was at about my strength level. So I asked him and he said, oh, no way, I can't do that. And I told him the whole thing, you know? And so he said, okay. So we started working on Bertel and I did that for 1 year. Every night, you know, 6 days a week. And then at the end of a year, it was really, I had two little kids. My wife, she was, you know, she never complained. She was always very supportive, but I could tell this was not easy.
Yeah.
And at work, I was making, you know, I'd sort of almost sneak out at 5 o'clock when everybody else was staying working till 6:30 or 7.
Right.
And so at the end of a year, I said, I just can't keep doing this. I can do it on weekends, Saturday and Sunday mornings. So we would have these 3-hour workouts on Saturday with Bertel.
Wow.
And I learned a lot. I mean, Bertel was a really good-hearted person in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah. You said you really learned how hard a champion bodybuilder trains and the amount of effort he put into it.
You have no idea. You have no idea. And there were times when people would fill in for Mike or me and I could just see, you know, the signs of retreat in their eyes, like, where you're doing curls with, you know, maybe 60 pounds, then 70 pounds, then 80 pounds, then 90 pounds, then 100 pounds, you know, like 5 sets. And you're swinging it, but you're going down slowly. And then you think you're finished. And then you go over and do one arm curls against cables. You know,
right.
Same thing.
Right.
5 sets. And then another 5 sets of something else. And it's just, the burn inside the biceps was like, or the burn inside any muscle was like something I had never experienced.
So what were your gains then, Rick, when you were in that year that you were training with Bertel?
Well, I never took measurements so much as it was just, how did I look?
Yeah.
I looked great.
Yeah.
You know, my waist was very small. My chest was big. My shoulders were big. Your arms were getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Now, you know, today in your 70s, you advocate training with lightweights, but obviously with Bertel, you were training with heavyweights.
Yeah. No, so, if you want to put on muscle, you have to use heavyweights. We all know.
Right. Right.
But on the other hand, there are so many benefits of lightweights with good form.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As you're in your 70s and 80s and 90s, you can do that. You can keep working out.
Yeah. I'm trying to get my parents are both in their 80s. And they're active. They walk and they ride bikes. And my mom does her exercises. And I'm trying to get them to go to a gym and train with weights. And like, no, we're fine. But I'm trying to tell them it's so much beneficial for your muscles and for your bones, like you said, and your circulatory system. It's a different way of exercising that the other things aren't gonna achieve.
That's right. It's like we have this magical secret that we know about, and nobody else, and we know how to do the exercises.
Yeah,
that's an important point that I've said to people, you know, well, let me show you. And they say, oh, I know how to lift weights. You know, OK.
Yeah.
No, what I found, too, in the reaction to the book is I'm getting almost virtually no reaction from people who do not work out. Mm-hmm. Whereas I've gotten hundreds of letters and emails from people who, but they all lift weights.
Yeah, yeah.
And very, you know, surprising. Like I've got one from a doctor who's head of a hospital and who's been lifting his whole life. And, mm-hmm. you know, a graduate of MIT and an Ivy League medical school who said, this is one of two books about lifting weights that totally inspired me or something.
Wow. That's great.
Back to him. I said, what's the other book?
Yeah, I think this whole COVID thing that we went through also shows how, you know, important it is for people to work out. And a lot of the people that were really adversely affected by that disease were the ones that were sedentary and didn't work out at all or were obese, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, we all know that muscle burns calories more efficiently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fat. And so, for myself, I mean, all I want to do is stay trim, stay healthy, stay energetic. I'm not trying to get a six pack anymore. I could get right. that. We could all get it.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's so healthy. When you get into your 70s and 80s, there are studies showing that a little bit of padding actually prevents bacterial infection.
Yeah.
We know it's a good cushion for falls and other things that happen with, so I don't want to get too skinny ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not looking to have 3%.
Yeah.
In my yeah,
it's very hard to do too, as you get older. I had a friend of mine from Chicago, actually, he's from Decatur. Merle Hall was his name. And he was competing in his 70s and he had a six pack. He was amazing. But he was like one of the very few that was able to do that, you know?
Right.
No. And he was a natural bodybuilder. He never took any drugs, anything. So he was really an amazing person.
That's terrific. That's
yeah. Really. Yeah. I want to ask you also, I want to talk a little bit about Bertel because, you know, we all know what happened with Bertel. Eventually he ended up shooting his young girlfriend and her mother and killed them both. And now he's in jail and he was supposed to be, I think, hung because he was in the Caribbean where he was, you know, where he went is in prison. And then they eventually they took away that sentence. So now he's still just going to be in prison for life. But you got a chance to know him. Did you ever see anything in his personality that would predict what he eventually did?
Yeah, I knew him really well. And yes, I did see, I mean, did hear about one thing. One time he called me, I was at the LA Times.
Okay.
This was right before the 84 Olympia.
Okay.
And if you watch it on YouTube, watch the 83 Olympia.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've seen it. Yeah.
The crowd in Europe, what did they do? They whistle instead of booing.
Yeah. Right.
Instead of booing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when he was announced fifth, the audience went nuts.
Yeah. He was amazing that year. Now, was that the year you trained with him, Rick, in 83?
Yeah.
Wow. So you got to see him in his best year.
I hand wrote a note before he went over, and I said, the thing to do is smile, because what you have a Magic Johnson kind of smile. You have, it's all charisma. The audience goes nuts every time he smiles.
Yeah.
And those 24-inch arms and all.
Yeah, that. And his chest, yeah.
And Kim, his wife at the time, was – we were very close. I've been trying to find Kim Fox. I'd love to send her a book, but I don't know where she is.
Mm-hmm.
When training and dieting for the 84 Olympia, and Bertel was pretty much starving himself. And he called me one day when I was at the LA Times and he was crying. He said, Kim left me and I need for you to call her and talk her into coming home. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, she doesn't know the pressure I'm under. I went to, I walked, in the apartment that he lived in, there was a little 7-Eleven kind of mini market or whatever. And he said, they have a granola bar and I just had to have it. So I ate it and then I felt like shit. And I'm just kicking myself for that. But she doesn't understand the pressure I'm under, not eating at all and no carbs and everything. So I called the number he gave me. It was Kim with her mother. She moved, you know, in San Francisco. and she was Jamaican. Bertel was from St. Kitts.
Yeah.
The island of St. Kitts. And Kim said, no, man, I will never go back. He stabbed me with a fork, and I got 9 stitches in my cheek.
Wow, in her face. Wow.
So I said, whoa, yeah, don't go back. I called Bertel. I said, nah, I couldn't talk her into it. You know, then I did tell Mike Myers. I said, whoa, that's really scary, man.
Yeah. Were you guys training with them in 84, too, Rick?
Yeah, on weekends.
On weekends, okay. Right. Wow.
And we would go to breakfast afterward, you know, all the time with Kim.
Yeah.
So.
When Arnold did that, like, cameo on Bertel's video, was that before the Olympia or after?
That was before the 83 Olympia.
Okay.
That was in, like, March of 83.
Yeah. Because I remember Arnold was at that contest because it was in Munich, Germany. Right. And I think he was cheering for Bertel.
Yeah, he would. I mean, in the video, I don't know if you've seen the full video, but he says, this is the future.
Yeah.
Sergio Oliva said that, too. When I was in Chicago, Sergio had a gym in Rogers Park.
Mm-hmm.
And I trained there. And this is now as an adult. I was, you know, in my 30s.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was talking with Sergio. He had those great signs all over the gym. Don't even think about dropping the plates. I love that sign. I told him. That's so perfect, especially.
Yeah, right.
I loved Sergio Oliva. And I told him I was working with Bertel. And he said, Bertel Fox is the future.
Yeah, he competed with Bertel in Europe.
Yeah, but he really admired. He thought Bertel was the next generation.
Wow! Yeah, he certainly looked like it. I mean, he had all the potential in the world, right?
We're like, you remember Victor Richards?
Yeah, yeah.
He would come over to World just to talk to Bertel and to look at him, watch him train. And,
no kidding. Yeah,
yeah.
I think Bertel was freaking everybody out back then. He was so big and he was so strong. You know.
I know.
Wow. Well, you've had an amazing life, Rick. You met a lot of great people. And I think this book is hopefully going to inspire more older people to start working out. You know, there it is.
Yeah. Or if you're working out, if you've worked out most of your life and you like bodybuilding and you enjoy it, the whole point is to figure out what routines you enjoy doing the most. Because I concluded that, you know, for years and years, it was no pain, no gain. But at some point, when you hit your 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it's the best workout is the one you like enough to keep doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We know we have good form. So that's the key to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's available at Amazon as both an ebook, a paperback, and an audiobook.
Okay. Are you still involved in the newspaper business, Rick? Are you still working?
We are. Creator Syndicate is still going and Creators Publishing. We're getting into that kind of digital publishing.
Okay.
My son, Jack, runs the business.
Okay.
Phenomenal job. But I try to, you know, we work very well together. We're very close. I worked out at the office gym this morning. He came in. He's moving today. So he came in. Said, I got 12 minutes, and he did a 12-minute workout, and he was gone.
Wow, that's great.
He said, stop by on your way home. So I said, okay,
because
all the things are in boxes. He's got
right. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well,
I'm going to compliment you on, because it's the same reason I complimented Rick Drayson. It is so important to preserve, like one of the things that occurred to me when my brother was doing that documentary.
Yeah.
That, like, when the United States was founded, there was no such thing as bodybuilding.
Right.
It didn't exist. It's relatively new.
Yeah.
And you and Rick and a few other like Dave.
Yeah.
Are preserving the history of it. And that is so important on this audio video history.
It is. Yeah, it really is.
That's where somebody like Jerry Brainham is so great. Cause he was there then too.
Yeah, I have Jerry on my show all the time. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important for the younger people because they don't know anything about it. And they don't have the magazines. That's where we all learned our knowledge. You know, we read all the magazines, and like you, I was the same way. I would read them over and over and over again. And, you know, so it's embedded in my mind now. People call me the bodybuilding historian because I've read these magazines so many times. I remember everything, you know.
You are.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, Rick. It's so important that Lee Haney actually contacted me. He wants me to try to write something that he could use in his personal training courses that he sells, you know, about the history of bodybuilding, because he agrees that it's so important that these younger kids coming up know about it and know where our sport went to. Because, I mean, it's in other sports, you know, basketball, baseball, football, they all know about the history there. So we should be the same in bodybuilding, right?
I agree 100%. Lee sent me the nicest email about the book saying,
"Oh yeah, great.
Thanks for spreading the word about the most important message," or something. You know, yeah. He has that famous quote that I just absolutely love, which is when you lift weights, it's to stimulate, not annihilate.
Right, exactly.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Right. All right, Rick. Well, best of luck with your book. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and sharing your stories with us. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. All right, Rick. Take care.
Okay, you too.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to all our generous Patreon donors who donate money to the show each month. I thank you guys so much. I could not do the show without you. If anyone out there is interested in being a Patreon donor, you can just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you see the link to become a Patreon donor if you choose to do so. All right. I think that's all we got. So I want to read this article for you guys. Again, this comes from the April-May 1971 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And it is the contest report from the historic 1970 Mr. Olympia contest where Arnold first beat Sergio. And what makes it even more important, it is written by Rick Wayne. It says, action-packed, thrilling, exciting, a night to remember. Some laughed, some cried. All agreed the 1970 IFBB Mr. World, Mr. America, Mr. Olympia show was the greatest event in the history of bodybuilding. Read all about it in this report by a competitor who also happens to be one of the most exciting writers in our business. Not even for one moment did we doubt that the 1970 IFBB Mr. America, Mr. World, Mr. Olympia show would amount to a phantasmagorical success, not with the ingredients at our disposal. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who so very narrowly missed his target last year, was making no secret of the fact that he was after Sergio's blood this time. On the other hand, the amazing Cuban emigre, more than ever determined to put the pesky Austrian in his place once and for all, continued to express unshakable faith in his own invincibility. Something had to give, and judging by the great number of tickets that were ordered, even before a date or venue had been announced, the fans sensed that this was going to be a battle of the giants, and they planned on being at the kill in droves. Then there was the Mr. America event. Almost daily, reports poured in that to this office that to the effect that Don Peters, last year's runner-up, was in the greatest shape of his bodybuilding life. We heard Mike Katz was taking on a decidedly freaky in California. That's great appearance. And both Ed Giuliani and Pete Caputo had forsaken the East Coast and joined the gold rush to Santa Monica's most popular muscle emporium, each hell-bent on making 1970 a very good year. Time would tell. Johnny Maldonado phoned to say that he would teach Franco Colombo the facts of real life when they met at the Mr. World contest. And Roy Callender sent ominous messages from across the Caribbean to all who dared entertain thoughts of coming between him and the aforementioned title. It all pointed to a bone temp for fans and competitors. There was just one small hitch, however. The Brooklyn Academy of Music that had mercifully harbored us for so many years suddenly turned out to be, quote, unavailable, unquote. And though Bud Parker tried a number of other New York theaters, we still were without a suitable venue even by mid-July. For once, Fun City was proving unyieldingly unwilling to play. You might get the idea of the way we felt at that point when I tell you that for a while we actually considered taking the show out of New York. Can you imagine that? It would have been like stealing a baby from its mother. Then Lady Luck smiled on us. Bud Parker phoned one morning with the good news that he had struck oil. Perhaps not the best metaphor in this case, since it was oil that had slipped between us and those other adamant theater managers. At last, someone had decided to give us a break. We could use the town hall on West 43rd Street if we promised to adhere to certain conditions. We were required to leave the theater in the same clean condition that we found it, not to damage in any fashion the curtains and furniture, And most important, we were asked to leave our dreaded salad oil safely locked in the food cupboards at home. In short, we were expected to behave like normal human beings who respected other people's property. And like the saint that he is, Bud Parker stuck out his neck and he promised that we would be on our best behavior. Poor, poor, faithful Bud. Bud Parker chose October 3rd for the big event. And then another problem arose. We found out we would not be allowed inside the theater until 8 p.m. on the night of the show. Now we would have to find a place to hold the usual prejudging. More Excedrin headaches. Miraculously, for the second time in 1 year, we pleased Lady Luck. Tom Miniacello came to our rescue. We could have his Mid-City Health Club. Of course, this meant giving up a whole day's business, but then that's the sort of stuff that Tom was made of. His love for bodybuilding proved much stronger than the urge to get rich. The fact that the Mid-City is located in the heart of Times Square, a stone's throw from the theater we had rented, was not exactly disadvantageous. It would be an easy matter for Bud to transport the numerous trophies and other equipment from the gym to the theater. Things might have been a whole lot worse. During all this time, I had been busy preparing for my guest appearance at the Mr. Western America show that was held in California on September 19th. 2 weeks before the event, I was informed someone was staging the professional Mr. America contest. The cash prize involved helped me make up my mind to compete. It later turned out that I was voted the winner over Dennis Tenorino and Harold Poole, a situation that did much to boost my self-confidence after that dismal showing at the 1969 IFBB Mr. Universe contest. This victory spurred me on to train even harder, and by the time I left New York for my California appearance, many thought I was in the greatest shape of my career. Candidly, I was not looking forward to the prospect of appearing in Los Angeles. I heard so much about the blasé attitude of the West Coast bodybuilding fans. Rumor had it that even Sergio Oliva had failed to stir their blood. It had taken Arnold Schwarzenegger to get them to actually applaud, a fact that Arnold is determined Sergio will never forget. But I had given my word to Reg Lewis, the promoter. I could not back out. Came the night of the show, and as I stood under the posing light waiting for Dick Tyler to end his introduction, I braced myself for the worst. I made up my mind that regardless of how cold the audience turned out to be, I would do my best. At least I would have that satisfaction. Then the curtains began to open, slowly, ever so slowly. In the darkened theater, not a sound. Unhurried, I raised my right hand to the back of my waist, then my left. Slowly, I tensed the left thigh and the right, and then the whole body. The applause that greeted my first pose hit me with the effect of a high-potency hallucinatory drug. Unbelievable. They were applauding, whistling, shouting. That ill-reputed California audience, that audience which had grown hyper-choosy from a constant diet of Scott, Draper, Zane, and the other West Coast greats, was vociferously approving my every move. Incredibly, I was a hit in California. Even as I left the stage at the end of my posing routine, they were shouting for more. It was then that I decided to enter the IFBB Mr. World contest. And when Dick Tyler came rushing into my dressing room to tell me he thought I should enter the Mr. Olympia contest, my determination was further strengthened. I thought about Franco Colombo. He had just beaten Chuck Sipes in Yugoslavia, and he would prove fantastic competition in the Mr. World event. And then I also felt that a victory against the Sardinian would prove to the IFBB fans that Joe Weider had not waned after all. I asked Joe Weider for time off work so I could stay on in Santa Monica until the big show and was ecstatic when he agreed. Now I would sample the training atmosphere that had produced the new Schwarzenegger, that had changed Franco Colombo from an average bodybuilder into the superstar that he is today. I joined Pete Caputo, Leon Brown, Chuck Colras, and Ed Giuliani, who were all preparing for the Mr. America contest. For the first time ever, I embarked on a twice-daily training routine. Since this article is supposed to be primarily concerned with the big show, I shall save the training details for another issue of this magazine. Suffice to say that never before have I ever experienced such wonderful results in a two-week period. Truly, California is the land of the bodybuilder, and Gold's is the bodybuilder's heaven. Arnold Schwarzenegger turned up a few days after my arrival, full of confidence and incredible muscle. He had been to London to beat the king, Reg Park, and on his way back to California had stopped over in Columbus, Ohio, where he pleased some 5,000 weightlifting and physique fans by beating Oliva for the professional Mr. World title. I was surprised to find Arnold hardly spoke of his latest victories. He seemed much more concerned with the job at hand, the job of preparing for his assault on the Mr. Olympia title and Sergio Oliva. It was as though he knew that he would not be accepted as bodybuilding's kingpin until he had beaten Oliva in the Mr. Olympia contest before highly knowledgeable IFBB judges and fans. Arnold could hardly wait to prove to New York, to the same crowd that had accepted Oliva as undisputed king for 3 years, that the time had come for a change at the top. And he meant to force that change down the throats of those Oliva fans who had given him such a hard time last year. Sometimes during a break between exercises, Arnold would interrupt my own training by drawing my attention to a mind-destroying display of pump biceps and striated back. He looked stunning. Tan mahogany brown from the California sun, massive and ripped. He seemed unbeatable. And there were times when I thought training at the same time as he would not benefit me in the least. He has this sickening effect on a fellow's morale, you see. Once I heard him mumbling Sato Vos, and I even thought he was psyching himself to train even harder. But on getting closer, I was amazed to hear Vicky Vane, the man with the veins. And he kept saying that over and over as if it were some cult chant. I quietly told him that he should do something about his V's and W's. And in typical Schwarzenegger style, his laughter rang out loud enough to be heard from Venice Beach. I came to realize how really seriously Arnold Schwarzenegger takes the business of physique competition. His workouts at Gold's are only part of the preparation. Much of the work is done at home, where he poses under a specially rigged up light. Arnold actually purchased a movie projector so that he could study Sergio's physique in the privacy of his apartment. He owns many reels of film featuring Sergio in competition, and he's made such a study of the myth that he can tell you in advance every move this man will make on the podium. He knows Sergio's poses in the order that he hits them. He knows how many poses Sergio hits when displaying his arms. He owns many photographs of Sergio and is able to compare his best poses with the Schwarzenegger classics. Now, when he hits this, he will tell you, I will do this and this and this and this. He prepares himself to hit three poses to each of Sergio's. He feels Sergio is not a great poser, even though his physique is incomparable. One night after he bombed his calves for a full hour, Arnold called me into the gym locker room. Ricky, he said, you must remember that no matter how great you are on the posing platform, if you have a small fault, people say, if only he did not have this fault. They do not talk about your great points, only the weaknesses. And for the first time in this 5 years that I'd known him, Arnold was serious. Then he said, Ricky, I will psych out Sergio so badly before the show, he will be like a baby. And I will take the candy from his hand like this. He made a sweeping motion with his left hand. I was to learn some days later exactly what he meant. I still had not set eyes on Franco Colombo. He had stayed on in Europe with Frank Zane and Dave Draper after the NAVA Mr. Universe contest. I guess they'd be bombing in preparation for the big IFBB event. 5 days before I left LA, Franco called Artie from Munich to make inquiries about my condition. Artie told him I was in great shape. He then asked Artie if he thought I would beat him at the Mr. World contest. Artie replied that we were both his friends, that we both looked in peak condition, and he would hate to comment without having us before him together. Never mind, retorted Franco. I take him by the neck. Franco, Arnold's self-confidence had rubbed off on his roommate, evidently. But I would not be fazed. Too many seasoned physique contestants who ought to have known better have allowed themselves to be overcome by Arnold and Franco's display of self-confidence. I am of the opinion that a man who believes he will be beaten by an opponent usually ends up getting whipped. I was in the best shape of my life and felt, rightly or wrongly, that it would take much more than Franco had to wipe me out. I flew into New York one day before the show, just itching for action, literally oozing self-confidence. I was determined to win not only the main Mr. World Award, but some major subdivisions too. My training had been geared towards that goal. Thanks to Joe Weider and Artie Zeller, I had perfected a number of new poses. I even practiced some of Colombo's best shots. So great was my determination to outdo him at his own game. On the morning of October 3rd, I arrived at the Mid-City to find Bud Parker surrounded by some of the biggest names in bodybuilding, each with a question for the famous show organizer. There was Mike Katz, about whom I heard unbelievable things in California, looking like something straight out of Edgar Allan Poe. I checked out Pete Caputo, a knowing smile playing about his lips, Leon Brown brimming with the self-confidence of a Western America title holder, Chuck Colras, whom the Gold Boys call the Gopher, and Barbados's Roy Callender, mysteriously attired in black turtleneck sweater, black pants and shoes, and black leather jacket. A picture of precipitated gloom, I thought, as though he had dressed with a funeral in mind. More contestants arrived by the minute, a few late arrivals from Spain, Grenada, Asia, and Trinidad had to be registered and assigned to their proper height categories. I was proud to note that for the first time ever, my native island had sent a representative for the Mr. World event. I recognize him as Robert Sandiford, IFBB director for St. Lucia. Due to a mix-up of plane schedules, he had arrived only a few hours earlier. Bud took care of him. By 11 a.m., there were some 200 bodybuilders, some very well-known, others up and coming, sitting around the Mid-City locker room, rapping about everything to do with bodybuilding, as bodybuilders are prone to do. The main subject under discussion was, as usual, Sergio Oliva. No one seemed to pay too much attention to the fact that the myth had been beaten by Arnold Schwarzenegger just 2 weeks before. It was as though the Ohio contest just didn't count. As far as most of us were concerned, the three-time winner of bodybuilding's top award would remain numero uno on our books until someone beat him in the Mr. Olympia contest. Many considered Sergio unbeatable in a fair contest, and some even stated that Arnold could only beat him if the judging panel was biased. Then someone casually mentioned that Sergio might be competing for the Mr. America title. The remark inspired much laughter. Even Mike Katz managed half a smile. I had heard the rumor some months before, but I paid little attention to it. The whole idea is so preposterous. However, some of the Mr. America contenders were sufficiently disturbed by it to go running to Bud Parker for verification. Bud told him that he heard nothing to indicate Sergio was interested in anything more than the Olympia title. But then he added that since Sergio was now an American citizen, he could, if the mood so struck him, compete in the Mr. America contest. That possibility was enough to inspire much activity in the Mid-City men's room for the next 15 minutes. Sergio Oliva arrived a little later. He was attired in a light blue sports shirt with short sleeves that were split to his enormous deltoids, exposing the expanse of unbelievable arms. Fantastic. His light brown pants seemed ready to pop at the slightest provocation, and the tan Cuban heel boots glistened under the Mid-City lights. Predictably, the Oliva crown jewels were much in evidence. They rattled from his neck and left wrist and dazzled all who dared gaze at Oliva's right hand. There were some new items of obviously high value on his right wrist and his left little finger, and I made a mental note to check them out at a more appropriate time. Before anyone could talk to Sergio, he introduced Bud Parker to his brand new manager. By this time, the three-time winner of the Mr. Olympia title was surrounded by Mike Katz, Pete Caputo, Leon Brown, Don Peters, and the other Mr. America big guns. And they were not actually admiring Sergio's arms or even his jewelry. No, they were not looking, only listening. And then Sergio put their minds at rest with an announcement that many had made 1,000 times before without driving anyone mad. "I wish to compete in the Mr. America contest," said Mr. Olympia, simply. Sergio's words were enough to throw a deathly silence on the front office of the Mid-City. Bud Parker smiled, not really believing what he had heard. Mike Katz pulled a face that would not be out of place in a Frankenstein movie, like Lurch with a pulled sacriolic. Pete Caputo bravely tried to smile his way through the predicament, but his smile slowly disintegrated into a sickly grimace, indicating the hurt he felt inside. One can only guess what went on in the minds of those Mr. America contenders at the moment of Sergio's announcement. Some had spent years preparing for the Mr. America contest. Don Peters had told me days before that he was in the greatest shape of his career and he felt he would take the big title this year. Mike Katz seemed confident, until then, that 1970 was going to be his year. And the smile, which minutes before Sergio's arrival lit up the handsome face of Pete Caputo, indicated he felt he was destined to wake up next morning as Mr. America. Suddenly their dreams had been shattered by the possibility, no, the fact that Sergio had decided to compete against them. Mumble, mumble, groan, controlled chaos. A number of people tried to persuade Sergio to change his mind. No dice. He said, not without the truth, that he had every right to compete in the Mr. America contest just like any other American citizen. Jules Levine of R&J Health Studios tried. Hard luck. Others tried to get through to Sergio's manager. He shrugged his well-padded shoulders negatively. Then I had a try. I took Sergio aside and I pointed out that he would be doing himself no good by competing for the Mr. America title. I told him all of bodybuilding considered him to be the number one man and he'd be damaging his popularity by denying the other Mr. America contenders a real chance at the title. No good. Then I said he would be placing Arnold at an advantage if he exposed his physique to the eyes of the judges before the Mr. Olympia contest. and for a split second, I thought I had reached him. But then he told me he promised his buddies in Chicago that he would take the Mr. America Award back home to them, and he was not in the habit of backing down on his word. My efforts had proved futile. Now it was left to Bud Parker. Bud gave Sergio all the arguments that many of us had offered before. Sergio refused to change his mind. Then his manager offered this solution. His boy would not compete in the Mr. America contest if Bud Parker gave his word that he would receive all the Mr. America trophies, the main award, plus those that would normally be gone to the winners of the various subdivisions. Moreover, Bud was to make a special announcement at the show to the effect that Sergio had decided to not compete for the title, since to do so would have reduced the event to a no contest status. And the IFBB had decided to honor Sergio with all of the Mr. America trophies and recognition of him being, quote, the greatest of the Mr. Americas, unquote. The whole thing reeked of blackmail. But what could Buddy do but agree? The Mr. America contestants were threatening to walk out if Sergio competed. Sergio's manager agreed to wait a few days for Bud Parker to purchase the $1,000 worth of trophies, and peace returned to the mid-city. Mike Katz regained his normal composure, and Pete Caputo smiled again. At 11:45, Arnold Schwarzenegger arrived at the mid-city with his sidekick, Columbo. Unlike Sergio, who this year decided to give everyone an idea of the bombs in his armory by wearing sports clothes, Arnold was well covered up. He wore a brown striped shirt, light brown pants, suede jacket, and a $1 million smile. "What you know, Sergio?" he called to the myth. "Have you eaten?" Sergio said he was not too hungry, and anyway, the judging was about to commence. Arnold then put both hands around Sergio's massive left arm and exclaimed, "I can't believe it. I can't believe it." And as if it were all part of a well-rehearsed act, Columbo said, "I believe it. Anyone can lose a few inches. Have you lost weight, Sergio?" And everyone laughed. Everyone except Sergio and his manager. The psyching out had begun. Then the telephone rang. Bud Parker answered it. 2 seconds later, he put his receiver back in place and told us Dave Draper had just called to say that he would be competing in the Mr. World event. Damn the man. As if Columbo were not enough to cope with in one contest, I almost changed my mind about entering. Later, I went to Columbo with the news. "Dave is competing?" he asked. "Well, then I beat him too." That was all I needed to hear. I decided to give both them the battle of their lives. Draper arrived as the short class Mr. America contenders were lining up before the judges. The panel included Arnold Schwarzenegger, Frank Zane, Ed Jubenville, Reg Lewis, who had decided to compete in the Mr. Olympia, Tom Minichiello, and other leading bodybuilding personalities. Dave looked massive in his denim shirt and pants. He went straight into the dressing room and I followed him. "Hiya, Dave," I said by way of a salutation, all the while checking him out. He took his shirt off and I was amazed at his size. As usual, he was the most polite, telling me it had been a last minute decision to compete, that it would be a good contest with Franco, him, and me competing. He changed into his shorts and I thought he was not so far out that the judges would find their job easy. Satisfied, I returned to where the action was on the gym floor and I watched the short class Mr. America contestants go through their paces. There was Johnny Iano, much improved over last year's appearance, Victor Miranda, Ed Giuliani, almost without a flaw in his physique, Leon Brown, muscularly dense and cut, Joe Nista, and others. The judges would have a hard time separating these men, I thought. Later, the medium height boys took their places before the judging panel. Pete Caputo stood out here. He had bulked up to 230 pounds, and then he came down again to a hard 205. He seemed more massive than before with that indefinable Mr. America quality about him. Gordon Babb, too, was impressive. They did their thing on the judges' instructions and then made way for the tall boys. I could see Draper and Columbo pumping for all they were worth in the corner of the mid-city. Let them note I have not bothered even to change into training gear, I thought. Let Franco get a real taste of psyching. It seemed to me that Mike Katz would prove an easy winner of the tall division. His chest was simply unbelievable. And with his incredible width, he appeared to dominate his category. I would have liked to see Tony Carroll standing next to him, but for reasons best known to himself, Big Tony decided to bypass this year's Mr. America contest. Don Peters looked lean and sharp. Dave Shepard was more massive than ever before. Now it was time for me to prepare for battle. I changed into my sweatsuit and I joined Franco, Draper, and the other Mr. World contenders for some barbell work. As with the Mr. America contest, the Mr. World was prejudged by classes, beginning with the short boys, Johnny Maldonado was great. So was Elliot Gilchrist. But it was most obvious that Franco Colombo would have little trouble winning this division. He was thick, tanned, and cut to ribbons. His calves had improved tremendously, and his posing was a dream. Joe Weider had taught him well. So it was my turn with the medium height competitors. Roy Callender stood on my left, massive with gigantic arms and pecs. He weighed about 210 pounds at 5'7". Trinidad Steve Burnett was also most impressive. We went through the usual poses as called by the judges and then made way for the tall class. Draper stood out here. But while he looked great, I still thought the Mr. World battle would be between Colombo and me. Draper's legs, which have never been his best body part, seemed particularly undertrained this year. His arms were not outstanding, and his back lacked density. Still, he was a force to be reckoned with. Franklin Green of Trinidad showed much improvement over last year's appearance. His training under Tom Miniacello had proved fruitful. As always, Vic Downs impressed, but I thought Dave would have an easy win. Now for the moment I've been waiting for. The judges called the three classes before them for comparison. I placed myself next to Colombo with Draper on my right. Suddenly, Colombo moved over, leaving Draper in the middle. I shifted over between him and Draper. Now Bud Parker ordered us to keep our places, and I was where I wanted to be, next to Colombo. On the judges' instructions, we hit a number of poses together. Then they asked those who wanted to compete for the subdivisions to come forward. Franco and I had a time hitting the most muscular, best back, and best abdominal poses. Last year, I did not bother with the subdivisions for good reason. But now I was having the time of my life shaking the incredible Franco. I noted that he did not come up for the best arms comparison. Draper did, with Callender, Green, and a few of the others. Someone called for the double bicep shot. Up came my arms, and I knew I was home. But then Arnold smiles at me and he calls for the best forearm poses. Who ever heard of that? I could only assume he was having some fun at someone's expense. Or could it be that he was giving Draper a chance to shine? Soon the judging broke up and you'd have thought I'd been voted the winner. Most thought the fight would be between Franco and me. We received congratulations, Franco and I, from all the guys who were watching. Sergio and Bruno Sammartino said they would not like the job of deciding who was more deserving of the title. Few thought Dave was at his best. As far as I was concerned, win or lose, I had achieved my purpose. Rick Wayne was back in the ratings, and it felt good. We left the mid-city around 3 p.m., and I could hardly wait for the show. I have no idea where Sergio disappeared to. Arnold, cool as always, said he was heading for his hotel to get some sleep. We met again backstage at the theater some minutes before the packed house had turned out for the show, as anticipated. One could almost feel the audience expected something different. Backstage, Sergio sat in the corner with his manager. We could hear Bud Parker welcoming everyone from the stage. And then he introduced Ben Weider, president of the IFBB. Ben spoke for a few minutes, letting us know how close we were to being accepted by the Olympic powers. Soon, he said, bodybuilding would have the same recognition as hockey, football, ice skating, or any other sport. And everyone applauded. Welcome news indeed. Ben Weider left the stage to tumultuous applause, and Ben resumed his master of ceremony duties. He introduced a fantastic hand balancing act that left us all dumbfounded by their feats of equilibrium. They earned the ear-splitting applause of the audience. Next came the Mr. America contest. But before the first man mounted the podium, Bud Parker came on to make the announcement that Sergio had been honored by the IFBB as the greatest of the Mr. America winners in accordance with his manager's wishes. On they came, one fantastic physique after another. Pete Caputo looked a sure winner. Then Ed Giuliani came on. He too looked great enough to win. Johnny Iano brought the house down, and many thought Don Peters was a dead cert for top honors. But then Mike Katz came on, and the house just broke up. The man is bigger than Arnold Schwarzenegger, or so it seemed. His posing routine is unlike any I ever saw. His hair falling over his face, Mike looked more monstrous than ever. If all it takes to win the Mr. America is a massive and defined muscle, he is a sure winner, I think. But I know the judges have the final word. Ed Jubenville came on afterwards and earned the right to call himself the greatest muscle control artist in the world. He performs controls that are plain incredible, and the audience loved him. Here is a man who must be well into his late 50s, but who possesses the physique of a 30-year-old. Now it was Frank Zane's turn. Buddy introduced the winner of the NABBA Mr. Universe title, and even before he appeared on stage, the audience was applauding excitingly. Frank did not disappoint them. Here indeed is the most symmetrical physique in the business. Not overly massive or muscular, Frank's body combines ideal size and proportions. He was deservedly a hit. The Miss Americana event followed Frank, 10 beautiful creatures who added feminine sex appeal to a great show. The fellows in the audience had a field day wolf whistling, and the girls showed their thanks with blood-stirring wiggles. Then Bud announced that it was time for the Mr. World contest. I hurried backstage to join Franco, Draper, Callender, and the other guys who were doing their darndest to pump up even more mass into their already super large torsos. Franco seemed particularly frisky, so I asked him why he was so nervous. He replied that he was merely trying to liven up the backstage scene. Just then, Arnold came down with the news that he'd been able to secure some vein tablets for his buddy. That was meant to be funny, but I merely sneered at him. I retaliated with a hint that Sergio planned to wipe him out once and for all that night. He'd have thought I said something funny. The guy doubled up with laughter. Sergio Oliva sat aside with his manager as though the two were in a deep meditation. How different he was. Last time, he and Arnold kidded each other for a full half day. Now Arnold's very presence seemed to have an unnerving effect on the big man. Even then, no one had been able to take a look at Sergio. The guys in the Mr. World contest started moving up to the stage in fives. Soon, only Franco, Dave, and I were left. I noticed Sergio had changed into a long dressing gown that exposed no more than his head and feet. Arnold had started pumping up now, attired in nothing more than his posing trunks. He still looked unbeatable. But then I had not had a chance to see Sergio undress. A call came for Franco and the rest of us Mr. World competitors to stand in the wings. A few minutes later, Buddy announced Franco. The roar that came up from the audience was deafening. Slowly, the Sardinian walked up to the platform, and I started wondering what I let myself in for. I could see him clearly from where I stood at the side of the stage. He really was amazing. He seemed to be posing even better than he did at the pre-judging. No more the awkward bodybuilder I knew 2 years before in Germany. This Franco was a master of stage presentation, a superstar who deserved public acclaim. His every pose drew wild applause, and when he hit that most muscular shot, I thought the roof would cave in. But now it was my turn. Buddy said simply, "Rick Wayne of New York and England," and I knew the New York crowd had not forsaken me. Why, I could hardly believe the applause. The whistling and stomping was all for me. I took my time getting up to the platform, and then I hit my first pose. Oh, it seemed like I was at a Beatles concert. So great was the wave of enthusiasm that greeted my every move. I was getting the same treatment accorded to Franco, at the very least. Then I bowed and walked off. Dave Draper was next. Just the mention of his name evoked shouts of delight from the packed house. They had not seen Dave for nearly 3 years, and one could tell they had missed him. But after the first two or three poses, the applause did not seem quite as vigorous. I thought Dave had not lived up to their expectations. Maybe I merely imagined it. But soon it was all over. The truth would now be known. Now we would know whether the sweat, toil, and sacrifice had been worthwhile. The winners would soon be separated from the losers. The first announcement proved encouraging for me. I was declared winner of the Best Poser trophy, the third time I've been thus honored. I later collected four more trophies for winning Best Arms, Best Back, and Best Abdominal subdivision and my class. Franco took most muscular, best legs, and his class. And the main award went to Dave Draper. Soon the Mr. America awards had been distributed, details appear below, and we cleared the stage for the Battle of the Titans. I rushed downstairs to where Sergio was busy applying oil to his enormous body. He was even heavier than last time. His waist still appeared small, but the hardness was not there. His shoulders were incredible. A few feet away, Franco was giving Arnold the once-over. He brushed off some oil here, straightened his trunks there, and then he told Arnold he was as ready as he'd ever be. "Give it to them, Arnold," he said. Upstairs, Reg Lewis was all set to go on, but Sergio and Arnold still had not decided who would pose next. Joe Weider suggested that someone should flip a coin, but then Sergio's manager pointed out that Sergio should not be denied the right, since he was the current Mr. Olympia, to pose last. Arnold smiled, and Joe agreed. Sergio would pose last. Reg Lewis went on and received a warm hand from the audience. Many thought he was not up to Mr. Olympia's standard, but respected him for being man enough to compete, more than can be said for some other so-called greats. Reg came off, and Bud Parker started his introduction of the Scourge from Munich. I cannot describe the ovation that Arnold received. There he stood on the platform, this 23-year-old physique phenomenon, smiling his way into the most incredible muscle display ever witnessed on Earth. He was enjoying himself and the audience loved him. His every move was a signal to applaud and scream, and the audience obeyed. Arnold could do no wrong, and he didn't. His presentation complemented his physique, smooth and utterly professional. Arm shots that blew every mind in the theater followed chest poses that were just unreal. Arnold really was giving it to them. Then he bowed and walked away. Few heard Buddy introduce Sergio. Arnold was still walking towards the wings when the now familiar chant began. Sergio, Sergio, Sergio. The fans had witnessed a miracle and they were impatient to see what Sergio had in store for them this year. Sergio came on, smiled at the mad, mad audience, and then began his posing routine. He hit the same poses that we had seen for some three consecutive years and drew vociferous applause. But I got the impression many were applauding out of habit, as if it were the expected thing when Sergio was on the posing platform. From where I stood watching, screaming, praying Sergio might win, he looked a beaten man. Gone was the fire, the veracity that once was synonymous with his muscle displays. The oil dripped down his massive body like sweat, so much oil that whatever definition he might have had suffered badly. His waist appeared soft in spite of its minuteness. After Arnold's display of masterful posing, Sergio's efforts seemed amateurish, lacking any semblance of polish, way beneath the class of a three-time Mr. Olympia winner. I am a Sergio fan, and believe me, it hurts to write this report. But then it would hurt a whole lot more if I wrote that Sergio was his usual great, incredible self. I would be lying if I said my hero put on a dazzling display. I was not one of those who screamed for Arnold. Certainly, I had not forgiven him for trying so desperately to place Draper in a position to beat me for the Best Arms Award. Forearms, he had shouted, when everyone else was concerned with biceps and triceps. Yes, I prayed Sergio would win just one more time. But I'm not blind, even though I might be biased once in a while. I knew the truth, and it hurt. Sergio had come on like a lamb to the slaughter. Whether Arnold's win over him in Ohio had unnerved him, I do not know. But it seemed to me as I watched him hit those familiar poses that Sergio Oliva appeared tired, listless, and in great need of a rest. At the end of his display, I thought the police would have to be called out. The fans were having a battle of their own. Arnold Schwarzenegger fans versus Sergio Oliva fans. Arnold, 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 they shouted in time with the Sergio, Sergio, Sergio set. But the judges were not ready with the result. Someone suggested the two giants should return to the posing platform for a pose down as they did last year. I watched them pose. Arnold's hitting three to each of Sergio's, and their every action accompanied by cacophonous screams from the audience. But suddenly Sergio walked away, leaving Arnold alone on the podium. Arnold turned in the direction of the departing Sergio and shrugged his massive shoulders disappointedly. It must have seemed to the fans that the great Sergio was throwing in the towel. And his fans did not like it one little bit. Now the only name for all was Arnold. Many were actually booing Sergio. It was like a horrible nightmare. And I prayed I would wake up to find Sergio was still the big hero. But this was no dream, only harsh reality. Then Sergio returned. The two hit more poses until Bud Parker announced that the judges would like to take a close look at them backstage. 2 minutes later, the immaculately attired Bud returned to the microphone with the news that few of us had expected to hear in 1970. Sergio Oliva has been beaten. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the new Mr. Olympia. And en masse, the fans rushed to the stage to congratulate the jubilant Austrian. Some 10 burly cops did their best to cope as the curtains closed on the greatest IFBB event, the greatest muscle spectacular ever staged. At last, a new king rules over muscledom. For how long, who can tell? This is not the end of the story. Next month, I'll tell you about the scenes following the big show, of my meeting with Sergio the following day, his future plans, and what he thought of the big contest. Read how Sergio reacted at his Waterloo. I have lots of inside information about Arnold, too. You won't believe it. I'll tell you all about his plans and his view of the great contest. I bet you'd like to know what Reg Park said to Arnold after the young Austrian beat him in London, their conversation in the warm-up room, et cetera, et cetera. You'd better tune in with the next issue of Muscle Builder. You can always count on me for the real facts, harsh as they sometimes are. I don't make the news. I just write them. Oh, I almost forgot. That Sergio walkout makes quite a story. It really was not as it appeared. And I'll tell it all next month. Wow, what a great article by Rick Wayne about the 1970 Mr. Olympia contest. Of course, a very historic contest. Oh, they got the results here. I'll read those. The Mr. America, Chuck Colras, was the winner of the short class with Leon Brown second and Ed Giuliani third. The medium class went to Pete Caputo with Chuck Fouts second, Gordon Babb third. Tall class went to Mike Katz with Don Peters in second and Dave Shepard in third. And then the overall winner of the IFBB Mr. America 1970 was Mike Katz. Best arms went to Pete Caputo. Best back went to Gordon Babb. Best legs went to Don Peters. Best chest went to Mike Katz. Best abdominals went to Chuck Colras, and most muscular went to Mike Katz. And then the Mr. World, Franco won the short class with Johnny Maldonado second and Elliot Gilchrist third. Rick Wayne won the medium class with Roy Callender second and Steve Burnett third. And then Dave Draper won the tall class with Vic Down second and Franklin Green third. The overall winner was Dave Draper. Rick Wayne won best arms, best back. Franco won best legs. Draper won best chest. Rick won best abdominals. And Franco won most muscular. And then Rick Wayne also won the best poser award. And then, of course, the Mr. Olympia. Arnold was the winner. Sergio second. Reg Lewis was third. All right. So that is it. Hope you guys enjoyed that. I know it was super long, but I just had to read it because it was a great article by Rick Wayne about one of the most historic Mr. Olympias ever in 1970, where Arnold beat Sergio Oliva. All right, that's it for our show this week. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Come back next week for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Stay healthy, enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.